Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
The following show may be pre-recorded.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is former state legislator Jeannie Ives, now the principal at Breakthrough Ideas. And Jeannie, the airlines don't want it. The science is pretty clear that we don't need it. But nonetheless, as sort of anticipated, as we anticipated here a couple of days ago when you heard from Dr. Ashish Jha of Brown University that an extension was certainly on the table. It's on the table that's probably going to be served, and that's what happened yesterday. 15-day extension on the travel mask mandate. We are now in day, by my count, 759 of 2 weeks to slow the spread.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Well, most people, you know, are thinking this just applies to airplanes, but actually it would apply to school buses as well. So there you go. Another fight on our hands. But I actually think people were just going to revolt. The last time I was on an airplane, I put it on to get through security. I took it off. I put it on to load the plane. Took it off when I sat down. Didn't put it back on.
The letter from the airlines that we talked about a couple weeks back when they sent it, finally. It makes no sense that people are still required to wear masks on airplanes, yet are allowed to congregate in crowded restaurants, schools, and at sporting events without masks, despite none of these venues having the protective air filtration system that aircraft do. Now is the time for the administration to sunset federal transportation travel restrictions, including the international pre-departure testing requirement and the federal mask mandate, that are no longer aligned with the realities of the current epidemiological environment. Au contraire, saith the CDC, BA2, Omicron the sequel, still very much a problem. There's been an increase in the 7-day moving average of cases in the United States. I'm sure you've been following this like the Dow. In order to assess the potential impact of the rise of cases, the rise of cases has on severe disease, including hospitalizations and death and healthcare system capacity, the CDC order will remain in place at this time. Yeah, I mean, you know, they have the 7-day moving average. So, you know, point set match, I guess, on the topic. It seems to me, Jeannie, what you're saying is correct. I think it's observable. You know, so you say, well, I don't even want to hear about it. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to think about it. I'm done. Well, I know a lot of people are done and they're ignoring so much of the silliness. However, when you have mask mandates on things like commercial aircraft, it's a bit hard to ignore. And, you know, is it a more than a minor inconvenience to have to wear a mask for 3 or 4 or 5 hours on a plane? Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Because it's still symbolic of complicity with madness.
They don't work. That's the problem. It's like participating in a lie. That's my problem.
Well, that's exactly it.
Don't get it.
No, and also you were still in, I mean you're it's a lie on the science. Mm-hmm. It's a lie when Tony Fauci says over the weekend, you know, about major events, you know, gatherings of a lot of people, that, you know, everybody's going to have to make their own decision what their risk tolerance is. Well, that's not true. That's not what they really believe. Sort of a political posture, rhetorical statement they make on the Sunday talkies to say, you know, they're reasonable and they move where the science moves and really where public opinion moves. And yet you have this 15-day extension. March, I went back and looked on the White House page, March 16th, 2020, 15 days to slow the spread. April 14th, 2022, 15 days to slow the spread is essentially what they're saying.
Well, in Illinois, you're still under emergency orders. Pritzker reissued another emergency order on April 1st that does not come off until April 30th.
Sure, out of an abundance of caution.
And he's living in La La Land. Nobody's complying with that. Unless they're forced to. I mean, but you know what? Push came to shove in the city of Chicago as well, right? Lori Lightfoot still has her vax mandate for police, and they were supposed to be all vaccinated up by Wednesday.
That's a
and
fight.
And there's a few hundred people that still are not.
Yeah, and that's a fight going on everywhere. You have some members of the city council in New York pushing Mayor Adams to rehire those who were fired for not being vaxxed. But yeah, so again, like we were talking about it a little bit at the end of the show yesterday with John Cass, you know, there's still people whose lives are being more than materially interrupted, mm-hmm. whose economic future is increasingly uncertain, or they're still recovering from what did occur over the past 2 years. 2 years is a long time. And to be essentially in this running in place with these nonsensical, ascientific COVID restrictions, this is a lot of, to me, also, political cover your ass. You know, we're still so measuring it. We're still meticulous about the science. And so we just need a couple more weeks to see how this goes because we're men and women of science and data. And that's when we gather the data, then we'll make a determination. And, you know, the trend lines are good. We're moving in that direction.
Hey,
we're opening up.
I say but, keep it on.
Let's keep it going. Let's just hold on.
You know, keep it going all the way through November because they'll even have a more massive rejection at the ballot box.
I don't want to make false comparisons, but it's hard not to watch this play out in this country.
Yeah.
And not look at what China is doing in Shanghai with that lockdown. And
that's frightening.
Frightening is a word we've used to describe what government has done really fairly regularly over the last 2 years. And yet the things that supposedly frighten a free-loving people persist. But we play the screams, people screaming from their high rises because they're locked in their apartments, not allowed to leave. The drones that the Chinese government is sending out to, you know, stop yearning for freedom and stop opening your windows and yelling out. There's viral videos. A bunch of residents of Shanghai broke through a police line that's supposed to cage them in and looted a local supermarket because they don't have any food. And they wanted to stop waiting for the government to deliver food since they were starting to get a bit hungry. There's another viral video of that was taken from a building, you know, next to a building, across from a building. A team of mm-hmm. Chinese communist goons in hazmat suits come in to this guy's apartment and roust him and hit him with some kind of stun gun, and then take him out of his place to some additional, less hospitable COVID camp than his apartment building. But I mean, the thuggery and being a team shows up and rips you out of your home to take you away to some camp. These COVID hotels in Australia, in
right.
Canada.
Well, speaking of Australia, my brother-in-law is headed back to the United States after spending 30 years there. They thought they'd stay there forever.
Really?
But he wants his citizenship back. He still has his U.S. citizenship. He wants to live in a free country.
He's hitting the window that just opened up where he can actually get out.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
They were pinned in until recently.
That's right. Yeah.
What was his experience? Did he get... Did he get a free stay at the COVID hotel?
No, but he was a protester. He stood in the middle of Alice Springs, you know, town square, and did some video stuff with a microphone and said this isn't right, talked about his rights as a human being. I give him a lot of credit, and they didn't fall in with any of the government mandates, but they're in a quagmire right now because his wife is Filipino. She had a resident alien pass that lapsed, and they just thought they were going to stay there, and it was fine. They had a very good visa situation with Australia. You could come back anytime you wanted, stay 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're not going to let her in. The government's saying it's going to be 11 to 17 months before she gets in, yet their two children left Australia, where they thought they were going to maintain their home because they were getting mandates down from their employers. They left. They're in Florida. So, you know, my brother-in-law, sister-in-law spent all this time paying U.S. taxes all this time, married, U.S. citizen children. He's a veteran. He served in the Air Force. That's how they met. He was over there flying satellites from the middle of Australia. And they won't let her in.
How is she's married to an American citizen.
I know. But she let her resident alien card lapse.
And it's going to be a year to 18 months until she's...
That's what they're saying. She's better off going to Mexico City, I think.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, it would be, you know, come in
Locking
the old-fashioned way.
Mm-hmm. It's,
wow.
It's a horrific way to treat people that have been taxpayer citizens. They own six rentals in Florida. They're, you know, fine financially. She's not going to be a burden in any way.
Well, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, you know, it's and they're back. They're back. They thought that they wouldn't ever need that because they just figured they'd stay in Australia. But COVID changed everything.
Well, and I mean, that's just another commentary, too, on the law-abiding versus the non-law-abiding and how upside down our legal regime is and the people that are charged with implementing it. But the airplane thing, too, I mean, just thinking about that more, you know, the letters are fine as late as they came from the airlines. How about some CEO of an airline says no? I mean, we had restaurants protest and say, no, you know, come in and find me. I'm not doing that. I can't run my business that way. It's not right what you're doing. Why can't an airline? And I know you say, oh, well, they're, you know, the federal regulations and they'll be fined. And you know, the next time they need a bailout, they won't get one and so on and so forth. And they have duties to shareholders and employees. I understand. But, you know, at some point, can there be a collective moral collective moral pushback against this from an actual from you know those who compose these companies and lead them? No, this is wrong. This is antithetical to everything you say you are: science, data, respectful of people's freedom, and so we're not going to comply on Southwest. You fly Southwest, you fly mask-free. Come and shut us down.
Yeah, dare them. They won't do that. They won't do that. But
of course they won't do that.
You know, it also, you do, I am concerned about the Chinese situation. Will this be a tipping point for their society?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, the guy in that apartment that I was describing being rousted and then extracted by this team of hazmat clad communist goons, you know, almost a Tiananmen Square moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what did the Tiananmen Square moment produce in terms of Chinese society? I don't know. And I fear for America, too, particularly when you had, as we played yesterday, Republican Senate candidate, and now Dr. Oz and others at the outset of this, in the first months of this. We need to cut and paste the Chinese model in terms of pandemic response. Cut and paste. We're so blithe about our freedoms in this country. Bob, Buffalo Grove.
Thanks for taking my call, Dan, and good to hear you, Jeannie. We met at the State of the Union.
Yes.
Masks don't work. And how do I know this? Monday I had to go to a hospital. In the entrance, it said you cannot wear a cloth mask. You must say surgical mask. So with regards to the airlines, I wonder if they screw you with regards to the type of mask you wear. wear them because masks don't work.
Thanks for the call, Bob.
Yeah, but there was absolutely discussion at the school level, the ISBE level. Do we issue everybody an N95 and force that on all the children?
Mm-hmm.
So
the problem
here is the tyrants are still in charge. And until they apologize and recognize their mistakes, we are still very vulnerable to them continuing this.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning is Jeannie I. That's Jeannie Ives, former state legislator, now principal at Breakthrough Ideas. And this just came over the transom, Bloomberg News reporting. Elon Musk has officially launched a $43 billion hostile takeover bid of Twitter.
Wow.
Which was anticipated after he declined to take a board seat after he had accepted the offer to take a board seat. And after he spent the weekend, putting Twitter employees on the fainting couch by suggesting that Twitter may be dying, by listing all these accounts of celebrities who rarely tweet very much. And so what value do they really have? And, the number of followers doesn't tell you everything you need to know. That's not what, creates value for Twitter. It's the conversations and the information sharing that comes out of those conversations. Musk also suggested that Twitter's office be turned into a homeless shelter because no one goes there anymore.
I really like that guy.
He's growing on me.
He's a lot of fun.
He is growing on me. And now, oh my gosh, that literally there was a day off on Monday for Twitter employees for suffering the trauma of Elon Musk's tweets after he bought a 9% stake in the company.
Mental health day off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. They see their psychologist. Right.
The world doesn't make sense to them anymore. Elon Musk bought a stake in our company. And so now you've got, you've got a power play by Elon Musk. I mean, this is nothing new in terms of a hostile takeover. It's not something we haven't seen before in the business world. We've seen it a lot of times, and it usually follows basically the pattern that that we see here, which is, a big-time investor, activist investor, takes a position, starts to publicly complain about the company. The company doesn't respond to his liking, and then he launches this hostile takeover bid. The interesting thing, too, about this is, just as an aside, not to get too deep into the weeds on this, but Twitter doesn't have the dual-share classes that many public tech companies do. Those dual share classes leave voting rights and thus control with the company's founders, protecting them against an activist investor like Musk. So without them, Twitter is left probably, if to defend itself, to adopt some sort of poison pill plan, which is very costly. You sell stock at a discount to dilute the share, the activist investor, the person making the hostile takeover bid, dilute their stake. We've seen this in cases with Kohl's, with Papa John's as well. So, now we're just on the business side of it, and that's somewhat interesting if you're a fan of things like Game of Thrones. But the larger point here is, boy, what would Elon Musk do if he successfully did take over Twitter? What should he do? We started talking about that when he bought that 9.2% stake because, of course, that made him the larger shareholder and thus influence that he had and some of the suggestions he was making and the polls that he was taking on Twitter. But what does that mean for what would you like to see him do? And perhaps what would you like him to see him do as a canary in the coal mine for other big tech companies? Perhaps not the biggest of the big tech. He's not going to take over Google. He's not going to take over Facebook.
Right.
He's not going to take over Apple. But Twitter, the impact that this could have and what you'd like to see him, what would you like to see him do with the company? My initial thing was, you know, a prisoner release. Release all those individuals illegitimately banned from Twitter, the Alex Berensons of the world, the former presidents, for example, Donald Trump is an obvious one. But maybe the better play is, although it would be odd to do this, would be to destroy it from within, essentially shut it down. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Save it or crush it. Save it or crash it.
Twitter. It's useful. It is useful. And I hate it, but Facebook's useful too. It's an easy way to stay up with family and, you know, get information out to folks in a longer form. I can't do 280 characters, so I'm not really big on I don't do much Twitter. I had somebody run my Twitter when I actually was running for office. But I know it's very useful, and I know that the younger set, they prefer Twitter over Facebook. A lot of my kids, they just don't do anything on Facebook. So Facebook may die its own death as, you know, one generation replaces another technology from the previous generation.
Yeah, and as you have those kids you're talking about migrate to other platforms mm-hmm. like TikTok and so forth. I like Twitter too. We talked about this, you know, during the Parler flap when Parler was deplatformed by Apple and mm-hmm. and then others who followed. And let's, you know, everybody leave Twitter after Trump was banned, go to Parler, then Parler's deplatformed and then Parler's back. But the problem is Parler's just clunky.
Right.
It's not it's not as good a platform, number one. Number two, and this is often a problem for those that launch media from a center-right perspective and, frankly, are transparent about it, which is optimal, that shows integrity, but there's a lot of people that aren't interested in integrity. And it's just difficult to get the kind of community that you see on Twitter in a center-right media outlet or center-right social media platform. I mean, think about a social media platform that is not dominated by the left. Think about a social media platform that includes conservatives and a center-right social media platform or media outlet that is dominated by that attracts the left or the center left. It doesn't have to be equally, but I mean the way that Twitter attracts so many on the center right or conservatives too. I mean, obviously, I'm on it.
So that's the thing. Yeah, well, I think that's one thing for people to follow and share your stuff. That's something that Twitter and Facebook are very good at. Instagram to some degree, but what is I think find interesting and very useful actually are a Telegram channel, a Signal channel.
Yeah.
A Slack channel where you are in particular different groups and you follow one conversation that everybody is really – I think actually Telegram's pretty easy compared to a Facebook Messenger group, for example. I think it's not as useful overall.
But again, you know, Twitter is dominated by the left. Mm-hmm. By the way, libs of TikTok just got suspended on Twitter to the point and to Elon Musk's point. Which, you know, libs of TikTok post these great videos that Twitter account of these crazy leftists who post videos to TikTok. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. They get banned for repurposing the content of the left. But that's it, because, of course, it exposes the left for the hysterics and the silly people that they are.
So would you destroy Twitter for Twitter's sake, to destroy all that value to the people that are investors?
I think it's
because
different.
Another one would pop up. It's too useful.
I think it's different. I think it's different with if Musk is successful in a hostile takeover bid where he has control of the company mm-hmm. than if Musk is just sort of tweeting from a board seat and making his case at board meetings, but he doesn't have operational control of the company. I think it's different. I think maybe if Musk is serious, and we'll see, first of all, if he's successful, and secondly, if he's serious about making it making a return to its sort of free speech value proposition that was presented at its inception, then perhaps Twitter is salvageable. Because I agree with you. I think it does have utility. You follow a lot of interesting people that post either good articles or interesting comments on particular topics, and it gets conversation started. It gets you thinking about things or contemplating an angle you may not have seen. I mean, all that's good, and it's at your fingertips, and the way that you can search, you can gather a lot of information that you can then distill later on.
And you can gather a lot of people doing stupid stuff too, which is amusing, but politicians saying stupid stuff. And,
you catch people.
That's great.
Right. People expose themselves too, and sometimes literally expose themselves. So I think it's useful for gathering information. I think it is a good product that's been polluted by the censorious nature of the leftists in charge. So I think Musk could do something with it, and so I'm open-minded on the topic. But I still think that I think it is interesting, though, when we talk about building our own castles, conservatives, that are shut out of these institutions, and big tech is now one of those institutions, or marginalized within them, go build your own. And conservatives will come to Twitter, but leftists won't come to Parler. Conservatives will, spy on MSNBC or CNN. Some on the left will do so with Fox too, but it seems that it's very that the left is so much more siloed and adamant about being siloed than the right is.
Yeah, they're close-minded. Try and have a reasonable argument with some of these just on energy policy. They don't want to hear it.
It seems to me that one of the challenges is maybe not for profitability, but for cultural significance, is you have to figure out a way to entice the center left to come to platforms that do start from a foundation of a commitment to free speech. It's basically the values enshrined of our in the Bill of Rights is what's going to inform our media outlet, our social media platform, whatever, and have enough influence where the left can't ignore you and they feel like they need to migrate over and participate. That just doesn't happen with center right media outlets or social media platforms the way that it does with those same enterprises on the left.
Well, it's not really a social media platform, but I do find that Rumble is fairly interchangeable with YouTube because it's not one that you're sharing and following necessarily. It's a place to put a video and then search for it. I think that Rumble does a fine job.
And you're starting to see more content from a center left or more opinion from a center left migrate onto Rumble?
I wouldn't say that necessarily, no.
That to me is the trick.
Mm-hmm.
John in his car. Hey, John.
I hope people don't start touting him as a champion of liberty and freedom. I believe it was in probably 2019 I was listening to a finance podcast, and he was touting how pretty soon in kiosks he was going to have the robots put implants into your brain so that you could be more Bluetooth with your devices. So he's not a champion for liberty and freedom. He's probably a transhumanist, if anything.
Well, thanks for the call, John. It's a fair point you raise. I mean, like these big tech billionaires, or like politicians, don't fall in love with these big tech billionaires. I agree with that. I look at them like politicians. Elon Musk could have some utility here with respect to Twitter and sending shockwaves through the big tech world and, by extension, media. So that's useful. But I mean, a lot of guys, it's sort of like talking about Peter Thiel. I mean, Peter Thiel is a fascinating investor. He's a very smart guy. From Zero to One is an excellent book. I mean, so it's fun to crawl in the mind of Peter Thiel and get his perspective on things. He's great on concerns about Chinese communists, intellectual property theft, and other related matters. But he's also, one of these sort of futurists who wants to put his brain on a stainless steel body at some point and live forever. You know, so, yeah, right. Talk about Elon Musk in this narrow space and the utility he could have, the influence he could have, and the direction of a more free exchange of ideas, which is one of the hallmarks of a free society. That could be the good news, but it doesn't mean you adopt everything Elon Musk says or does in toto. Absolutely. Jim in Crown Point.
The Democrats, it's a cult. They have a doctrine. They stay with it. You tell them the facts, they ignore you. The Republicans are outside looking in. They will always be outside looking in until they create their own cult. That's simple.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Dan and Jeannie Ives in for Amy J. this morning, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and in for Amy this morning, former state rep Jeannie Ives, now the principal at Breakthrough Ideas. I'm sure you've seen Breakthrough Ideas content, gone to a Breakthrough Ideas event, and we've got a Breakthrough Ideas event coming up in just a few weeks, Jeannie, May 13th.
That's right.
What are we doing?
Abington in Glen Ellen. It's you and John Cass, and it's, about a decade ago, you said, is it time to turn Illinois upside down? Great posters about that. And we're going to ask that question of you guys in 2022. I'm sure the answer will be yes, but how does it happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're going to need to turn.
And will it happen? What's your prediction? We'll talk about all of that.
Yeah.
Dinner and discussion is going to be a lot of fun.
Let's see if anybody's got any change left in their pockets.
We're already halfway sold out, too. It's been up for a week, and the event is halfway sold out.
And people get more information and tickets at
breakthrough-ideas.com.
All right, let's talk about this police-involved shooting in Grand Rapids, Michigan that has led to protests. Black Lives Matter has descended on the scene in Grand Rapids, Michigan in response to video released by the police department there of an April 4th traffic stop by a Grand Rapids police officer of a guy named Patrick Loyola, who is a Congolese native. And this is how it went. We'll play the audio from the video. But so just so you have it in your mind, if you haven't seen it, it's a traffic stop. The guy's plate doesn't match the car. You know, the cop runs the plate, doesn't match the car. The first thing that the individual who was stopped does is get out of the car.
Bad
police police officer gets out of his car and says, get back in your car. He doesn't. Then there's then they're standing sort of face to face and there's an exchange. He says, well, get your driver's license. He says, it's in the car. Okay, well, open your car and get your driver's license. That doesn't happen. Then the officer attempts to place Mr. Loyola in custody, and a scuffle ensues. And a little pushing, shoving. Then Loyola runs away from the cop. He chases him. He catches up with him. He tackles him. The scuffle continues. He attempts to tase him, and you'll hear the officer say, taser, taser. That doesn't stop him. And then at some point, and this is the video is a bit distant, so it's difficult to make out exactly what happened. At some point, the officer is on top of Loyola, like he's straddling him. He's down on the ground. Officer's straddling him. There's still a struggle because you see them tussling back and forth, him getting moved around. And he reaches for something in his belt, which turned out to be his gun. You hear a shot. He shoots him in the back of the head and kills him. All right, take a listen.
Stay in the car. Get in the car. Dude, I'm stopping you. Do you have a license? Do you have a license? Who is? I'm stopping you. Do you have a license?
What does it?
Do you have a driver's license? Do you speak English?
Yes.
Can I see your license?
What does it want?
The plate doesn't belong on this car. Do you have a license or no? Do you have a driver's license?
Yes.
Where is it at?
It's in the car.
Get it for me.
What happened?
The plate does not belong in this car.
Right there.
No, 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 stop, stop. Put your hands up. Stop. 1915, got one running. Stop. Stop. Stop.
Okay.
Stop. Stop. Get your hands behind your back! Get your hands behind your back!
Now you say he's a good friend, man. Bro, yo, what's up, man?
Stop!
Okay. Stop resisting!
Now you good, you're not resisting nothing, bro.
Passenger is filming it.
Okay, why you gotta do all that, bro? He good, man.
That was the sound of a taser discharging.
Let go of the taser!
Taser! See the fatal gunshot in 10 seconds.
So, an important point there, drop the taser. So somehow Mr. Leoa had apparently gotten the taser, and that's when you had the officer pull his gun and shoot him. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Interestingly, the police chief in Grand Rapids, Michigan, is Eric Winstrom, who's a former Chicago police commander.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we've talked about him actually on the show before. He a pretty well-respected commander. He's somebody who pushed back against Kim Fox in one of the cases where she was loath to charge a criminal for violent criminal activity. He has said, I view it as a tragedy. It was a progression of sadness for me. From my view of the video, Taser was deployed twice. Taser did not make contact, and Mr. Leoa was shot in the head. However, that's the only information I have.
Well, it's interesting because it just feels like all of this could have been prevented, obviously. And you're going to have – apparently there's three different videos, angles from this. There's the cell phone video. There's, I think, a car video, and then there's
– body cam.
The body cam.
Right.
And so that's all going to have to come together, but – the problem here is that he should have never gotten out of the car. None of this had to happen.
Right. I mean, and it's not like, oh, he didn't, you know, he's an immigrant to this country. He didn't know. Well, you heard the officer say, get back in the car, get back in the car. The officer didn't force him back into the car. He was being reasonable. He wasn't armed. And so they were talking and then get your license. He doesn't do that. Then he, you know, physically engages the officer and runs. So, I mean, you know, the
progression's there.
Exactly. As we talk about in these cases all the time, it's usually not one bad decision. It's a chain of bad decisions that leads to a terrible outcome. And that was the case here. The question may very well come down to, and be interesting to get response from police, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. The suspect gets a hold of the taser, is shooting him a legitimate use of force in response to a suspect with the taser. particularly in the context in which he had it, where they were both on the ground.
Well, the other thing is it takes about a minute, 10 seconds by my count, before the officer decides to call for backup. But I would think almost immediately when he's not complying with getting back in the car, when he's not complying with the driver's license, then you should call for backup. So where was backup to deal with this situation? Plus, you've got another passenger in the car. Just seems
and that
odd.
And that passenger stayed in the car.
And that passenger stayed in the car.
Yeah.
Well,
it's another terrible case. I will also say this,
Dan. After the Sandra Bland incident, she was the girl who lived in Lyle, Naperville area, down in Texas, gets stopped by a cop, gets arrested, gets put in jail. Obviously, I think it was probably an excessive reason to put her in jail. She ends up dying in the jail cell. So it wasn't something that they did. But following that, the Illinois State Legislature passed a law that said, and it's right at the beginning of the rules of the road, and it tells you exactly the proper action when stopped by law enforcement. Slow down, safely pull over, don't slam on the brakes or stop in the lane of traffic. Number three, stay in the vehicle with both hands clearly in sight. Do not get out of the car. These are just rules that everybody should know.
It seems pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
I mean, not to mention, again, in this case, you didn't even have to know the rules because the officer was telling you the rules. So
that's right.
Compliance avoids 99.9% of these terrible outcomes that as we've seen. I mean, it's just the same story over and over again. Mm-hmm. And, look, I think Black Lives Matter and these leftists have some blood on their hands with respect to the silliness that occurs where somebody thinks that they can flee. Somebody thinks that they can physically engage an officer. They don't have to respect the commands of an officer in the field. They don't have the sense to say, if I think I'm being mistreated, well, I'll comply. And then if the officer was abusive or my civil rights were violated or there's an illegal search, then I will retain counsel and have, justice in a court of law, not on a street. I mean, who thinks that is going to end well? What kind of sense does that make? I mean, he's scared. Somebody's scared. Come on. These are adults. And what is this guy thinking? He's got two daughters at home. And you want to fight with a police officer? Over whatever. Was it a stolen? I don't know if it was a stolen car or what the deal was with the plate that didn't belong to that car. But whatever. You're not thinking about two daughters at home? Are you crazy? Come on.
And it doesn't appear that there was a language barrier.
No. He asked him, do you speak English? He spoke English.
Yeah.
When he said, get your driver's license from the car, he turned, he opened the door and he was talking to the other passengers in the car, and he clearly didn't have a license or he didn't have it on him because he couldn't produce it. And that's when things escalated because of what that person, Mr. Lioa, chose to do in non-complying and in physically engaging a police officer. And by the way, initially I thought when I first watched it, mm-hmm. I thought maybe this is a case like the Kim Potter case in Minneapolis with the Dante Wright shooting,
right,
where she thought she was grabbing for a taser and she grabbed for the gun and accidentally shot him, and she got 2 years in prison for manslaughter. But you hear at the end, let go of the taser. So the officer clearly knows that is clearly indicating that that Loyola has the taser, and that's when he uses his weapon. Oh, Phil and Darian, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. Listen, I really don't see what the problem is in this situation. It's like you say, Dan, 99% of these cases involve the same facts. These young black kids are taught to resist. Do not comply. They're only doing what they're taught. Well, I don't get it. I don't see what the problem is. They're only doing Black Lives Matter. They don't have blood on their hands. This is what they're teaching these kids. They love this. Look at how the local media reports the story. another black man got shot by a white cop. They don't care about the facts.
Yeah.
Never mind the facts. Black kid.
Thanks for the call, Phil. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they're taught to resist, but they're certainly taught to fear. And they're taught that the police is institutionally racist and that they're out to get young black men. They're out to kill. And this is the rhetoric we've been subject to for years now from Black Lives Matter and their associated apologists and their corporate financiers. And, you know, that has consequences. I mean, how pliable are the minds of so many? Have we not seen that through COVID? So you think that the sort of the COVIDian indoctrination or the CRT indoctrination that goes on in schools,
absolutely,
you think that that there's not cultural indoctrination to fear the police, to say I'm about to be murdered because I've been told by all of these people on TV and who get profile that there's just a bunch of racists out hunting black men like me? And then you have somebody do something stupid and it ends in tragedy. Bill, Northwest Side.
Hi, good morning, folks. Yeah, I think a good rule of thumb for any police officer to follow would be as soon as the person doesn't comply with the officer's first command, immediately call for backup. Don't go to the next level of making them comply until you have help with you.
Are you a former officer or current?
No, I have police officers in my family.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Well, and you know what you're going to hear in response to this, too, is no traffic stops. Like you're hearing from the you know, the non-prosecution, the defund the police mayors and prosecutors around the country. Let's just eliminate traffic stops. That'll solve the problem.
Well, that may happen in practice, depending on how these cases are determined.
It's already basically happened in practice in Chicago to horrific consequences. Yeah, traffic stops are dangerous for cops, but they're also a integral part of good proactive policing. And as soon as they started to move under triple threat away from traffic stops because
that's an alternate form of stop and frisk. We can't have that.
Well, as soon as they started to move away and officer said, okay, I don't have backing to do this, then you saw stops go down by 90% in a single year. This is before COVID. And, you know, and that's attendant to the spike in violent crime in Chicago over the last several years. Tony Steger.
You know, you had Black Lives Matter on there this morning saying what else could have been done. Well, the guy could have listened to the cop and not resisted, not ran, okay? And he probably would have just been let out of jail anyway. But he decided to make the wrong decisions, and nobody is sitting back and saying that. It's just a shame.
Thanks for the call, Tony. Speaking of Black Lives Matter, this is where Black Lives Matter is focusing their concern at present. One of the Marxist co-founders we've profiled on the show before, Patrice Cullors, she's been on a bit of a spending spree lately, buying up million-dollar houses in L.A. And Black Lives Matter as an organization has been, too, mansions in Canada and elsewhere. That corporate money is sweet, isn't it? Patrice Cullors, in a recent sit-down, talking about how nonprofit law is being weaponized against black Americans.
Yes, there has been so much clarity for me, a questioning for me. I don't know if I have clarity or answers yet, but I'm like, wow, this doesn't seem safe for us, this 990 structure, this nonprofit system structure. This is like deeply unsafe. Like this is being literally weaponized against us, against the people we work with. I can't tell you how many people are like, am I next? Like, are they going to do this to me? So there's not a lot of, that's like, when you know this, you run an organization, like people's morale in an organization is so important.
Yes.
But if their organization and the people in it are being attacked and scrutinized at everything they do, that leads to deep burnout, that leads to deep like resistance and trauma. And so I think that other piece for me around, you know, what I think it's is important for people to understand is, and it's connected to the, to this question, but there is a misinformation and disinformation effort to not just challenge Black Lives Matter and the organization, but it's an experiment. If they win, then it's the next Black-led organization.
Yes, it is.
And then,
well, Dan, I kind of agree. You know, Lois Lerner weaponized 990 forms.
Well, yes, right, against pro-life and conservative organizations.
That's right. You had freedom in your patriotic, anything in your title. Lois Lerner was going to scrutinize your 990 and your tax filings.
Right, but that's an unconstitutional.
Okay.
And Patrice Cullors is saying having to disclose salaries like you do on 990, assets, anything, yeah. The transparency that's required of 501c3s, all 501c3s, that's now somehow those laws predate Black Lives Matter. Somehow now those laws have been weaponized against Black Lives Matter, even though the requirement is equally imposed for all organizations that have a 501c3 designation. Now that's being weaponized and scrutinized. How dare you scrutinize us? How dare you report on how we're spending the $100 million or so, probably a lot more than that by now, $100 million or so we raised just in the first couple of years after the 2020 riots. How dare you question the home buying spree I went on? That's weaponizing the law against Black people. Hmm? So Patrice Cullors is focused on the downtrodden Black American, the Black American family whose kids are in terrible schools or live in violent neighborhoods, are wanting for economic opportunity. No, she's focused on the heat she's getting for her spending spree thanks to corporate America, while they run around pretending they're some sort of force for the good and benefit of the Black proletariat.
Yeah.
I mean, something.
It's embarrassing.
John and Kerry.
Good morning, guys. I just want to comment. Dan, you're right. They're going to say no traffic stops anymore. But I'm a police officer, have been for 32 years. Jeannie, to your point about calling for backup, as soon as he got on the radio and said he had one run, and guaranteed he's got five other units on the way, he's not going to call for backup or take up over radio time. It's important to know, too, that the average human can only fight at 100% for 15 seconds. And this was going on over a minute.
Yeah.
And it's important also to know, it's also important to know that every confrontation that we get, that we deal with, there's a gun involved, and that's ours. So he actually took the levels of force. He went hands-on, then he went taser. Taser didn't work. This guy grabs his taser. If he does get his taser and uses it against him, we're taught to go one level above where the offender is taking us. So that's what he did. This guy forced a confrontation, and it ended poorly for him.
Thanks for the call, John. Appreciate the perspective.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is former state legislator Jeannie Ives, now the principal of Breakthrough Ideas. And Jeannie, you're closer to this than I am, you know, as John Cass told everybody at my roast, I live in this ivory tower. You're down there with people.
I
know
am.
What's going on.
I am.
You're talking
with
to conservative activists. You are the people.
Yes.
So are you getting questions about State Senator Darren Bailey per some of the commercials from Richard Irvin, not so much the ones that you hear on our airwaves, but others, and mail pieces that have been sent around suggesting that Darren Bailey is some sort of never-Trumper who supported Biden and Obama? Are you getting questions about this?
Yes, I am. Mainly on my Facebook, not in person, because I think people know that I support Darren. But there are questions out there. People that aren't as close to me have asked me about it. I'm hearing this stuff, Jeannie. Is it true? No, none of it's true. And by the way, I hosted Darren for a meet and greet in Winfield last night. And it was an outstanding turnout. And he answered a lot of questions. And obviously, they're just lying about him like they lied about me. So,
well, first, I mean, in addition to that, I should say, let's hear from Darren Bailey. He posted a video in response to some of these charges. So Darren Bailey, in his own words, which is appropriate, he should respond face to camera directly to these specious lies the way that we had to when Bruce Rauner and the same people running Irvin's campaign were running his campaign of lies against you, Mike Madigan's favorite Republican. Seems like they think that the more outlandish the lie, the better chance their candidates have, which says something about their candidates. But here's Darren Bailey.
Friends, let me be clear. Richard Irvin is a lying liberal who has voted Democrat in every major election. He's backed by the failed establishment and is afraid to say where he stands on protecting life, defending the Second Amendment, and every other important issue that he's not trying to mislead you about on TV. No one in this world doubts that I'm a true conservative. Every time there has been a tough fight, I've taken it on. While Irvin was hugging J.B. Pritzker and locking down his city, and the others in this race were doing absolutely nothing, I was standing up and fighting J.B. Pritzker over his lockdowns to defend your freedoms. I have prioritized working families and taxpayers over special interests, demanded election integrity, fought for life and the Second Amendment, and I have supported President Trump in every election. I've always fought for our conservative principles. In 2008, conservative Rush Limbaugh, myself, and thousands of other Republicans helped bring chaos to the Democratic primary to help Republicans in November. Well, they're now lying and trying to fool you because they are afraid of the movement that we are building to win. I'm a lifelong Republican who has never supported a Democrat.
So the whole thing they're using is the one D blemish on Bailey's record, voting record, to say, oh, in 2008, he was supporting Obama because he voted in the Democrat primary rather than, for those of you old enough to remember, I'm sure that's most of you, Russia's Operation Chaos effort with respect to the Hillary-Obama primary in that election cycle.
Well, you know, Dan, in 2018, in that Republican primary, Rauner versus me, you know, we only lost by about 20,000 votes.
Yeah.
Well, 100%. There were 20,000 Republicans who moved over and pulled a primary ballot to save Lipinski. So are they also, you know, terrible Republicans?
Right. They moved. You know? Right. They went to vote Lipinski because they were pro-lifers.
That's
and he was running against
they
that
wanted to save him, which was a
person,
dumb idea.
Marie
but
Newman.
Whatever. Right. They did.
Right.
That could have cost me the election right there.
Well, and the other thing, too, I mean, now it's a different dynamic because you're running against an incumbent governor. And that's just a completely different kettle of fish.
Yes.
But it's similar in the sense of, you know, taking something and asserting that it is something that it isn't. You
that's
know,
right.
That's what they did with you, which is to say, like, you on some rather arcane health care bill, you worked with the Speaker of the House because, you know, you're Speaker of the House, but it was you saying this is good legislation, so I need to work with whoever I can work with to advance the legislation. And that was the basis which they said, Jeannie Ives is Mike Madigan's favorite Republican. So here we go. Darren Bailey, who is perhaps the most, I mean, I don't even think perhaps, the most conservative member of the General Assembly, and that's a fairly low bar these days, he voting as part of Operation Chaos in that 2008 Dem primary. So now he's an Obama and Biden supporter.
It's laughable. It's laughable. But you know what? Darren was out yesterday, and he said that he's got polling, shows him at 35% and growing. And that is after he's actually grown that lead after apparently Irvin spent $5 million so far.
Well, here's
good for him.
It's more like eight, and that's just on TV. But
okay.
I mean, here's the thing. You know, for Republican primary voters, I mean, and the reason we're connecting it to your race in 2018 is not because this is sour grapes. It's to say, do you see? It's the same people.
Yes.
Doing the same things. The names change. The dynamic doesn't. Are you really going to allow Richard Irvin and this crew to hoodwink enough Republican primary voters again to get the same outcome you got in 2018? And by the way, if you do, then you're going to get the same outcome in 2022 general election that you got in the 2018 general election. After Rahner so wanted to run for reelection that he was looking for a way out over the summer before he went on to a historic defeat, got crushed, the biggest margin for a Republican loss in Illinois history. I mean, you want to talk about the guy who only had base Republican vote, and mainly that was because of how noxious Pritzker is. You get like a third of the general election vote. You want to get your ass handed to you again in what promises, unlike 2018, to be a red wave, great Republican year. Certainly not since not since 2010, maybe not since 1994. You want Illinois to miss the boat once again, how we missed the Reagan Revolution, how we missed the Gingrich Revolution, how we missed the Tea Party Revolution.
Yep.
Do you want to miss it again? If you want to miss it again, keep listening to these hacks in the Republican Party, including some who call themselves conservatives, falling in because of Ken Griffin's money, falling in behind this fraud because of Ken Griffin's money. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Yeah, no, and I tell you what, he's got about the same amount of supporters as what he started with. I think there's maybe 60 Republicans on that list that are supporting Irvin. I don't know. Three quarters of them I've never heard of, so they're really not that important.
He's got a lot of state legislators, and of course, he's running with a state legislator. And as I've said before, in Illinois, the candidate who has the most elected officials supporting them is the candidate you should trust the least. It's inversely proportional, honestly.
Well, and if you're supporting Irvin, I'm not supporting you, period.
Greg, Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Hi, Jeannie. You know what? I my attitude is the same as many people I know who are Republicans. Number one, if Irvin does not come on this show in the primary, nobody I know, including me, is going to vote for him should he win in the primary and get in the general. I mean, you know what? This guy is just, he's useless. He's a, to call him a rhino would be beneficial to him. I don't know. It's just, nothing ever changes Illinois. They keep putting these clowns in. He's got boatloads of money going behind him. And what are we going to get? The same old, same old. You guys have a good day.
Thanks, Greg. Well, a couple things. One is Richard Irvin has had, and by the way, I've known Richard for 15 years. He's been on this show before as mayor of Aurora. He has had a open invite to come on this show since he was rumored to be the candidate Ken Griffin was going to back in the fourth quarter of last year. That's how long he's had an open invite to come on the show before he was even an announced candidate. And that invite still stands. If he's too much of a coward to go back and forth with somebody who disagrees with him, with somebody who's supporting another candidate, well, then he's too much of a coward. If he can't stand up to me, then you think he's going to ride roughshod over the socialists in Springfield were he to get elected, which wouldn't happen anyway, but just theoretically, of course not. And by the way, there are other candidates in the race I do like, but I'm not supporting them. But Gary Rabine will be invited back on the show over the course of the campaign to talk because he's an honorable guy, and I like Gary Rabine. Jesse Sullivan, I don't know as well. He's been on the show, and he'll be invited back on the show to pitch his wares. I'm not trying to crowd out candidates who want to pitch their wares to our audience, anybody's welcome on. I'm going to get that Max Solomon on, too, just because I think he's a smart young guy.
He is.
And we don't have enough smart young people in the Republican Party. So, you know, this is not like, oh, pay no attention, cover your eyes and ears for anyone except Bailey. Hardly.
Nope.
Hardly.
No. And Richard Irvin's also, you know, he's hiding from people. I have not seen him at a single political event, and I've been around at various events, and he's not gone to any governor forums that I've known. So we'll see what he shows up to in the future. But he's phoning it in over the airwaves and thinks he's going to win, and that's their whole idea. They do not want to put him in front of an audience.
Well,
apparently he's going to show up in Kendall County. That'll be interesting.
His first couple of interviews in Chicago media probably explains why.
Right.
The other thing, though, with respect to Irvin, per Greg from Jefferson Park's point, we'll have everybody on. We want everybody on. We want to have Irvin have a chance, and he can go toe to toe, and he can tell me I'm all wet, and he can say, but the stones of these guys. Not just to tell an outright lie against Bailey, but here's a guy who's voted in like 8 of the last 9 Democrat primaries, who has the gall to call himself a Republican, first of all, but then to attack somebody else as not a Republican because he participated in Russia's Operation Chaos 14 years ago. So Darren Bailey is not a Republican. The guy who voted in 8 of the last 9 Democrat primaries, he's the Republican. I mean, that takes some stones, man.
Same thing about hiking taxes. I mean, his running mate, Avery Bourne, doubled your gas taxes. She was a roll call vote for Jim Durkin, doubled the gas tax. Didn't think twice about it.
The roll call votes for the combine. Mm-hmm. And Bailey, I mean, and
she voted for Pritzker's tax increase. I mean, that's okay. Let's put that on a mail piece. Because she did.
That's a good point. And Irvin, too. These guys.
It's unbelievable. The lies.
We were just talking about Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm.
Irvin, in March of last year. March of last year, a year ago, after what Black Lives Matter has demonstrated it is for the previous 5 years, Irvin, I am a strong and passionate supporter of Black Lives Matter. That is a quotation from Richard Irvin's candidate questionnaire for the patch. How is that not disqualifying? Black Lives Matter is a Marxist organization that has instigated rioting and lawlessness. And Richard Irvin is out touting what a law and order mayor candidate he is. So the stones on these guys, stunning.
I got his mailer. I got Irvin's mailer to my house. J.B. Pritzker is afraid of Richard Irvin. No, he's not.
Please.
Richard Irvin's on camera praising J.B. Pritzker for his COVID policies and the great job he's been running the state. On camera.
John,
he's not afraid of you.
John in Marengo.
Hey, I just wanted to say, you know, this Richard Irvin, like you said, he's sending out these mailers and he's hiding, and, you know, he kind of reminds me of Joe Biden hiding in his basement. So Joe Biden hid, and he won. Not that it was legitimate, but he won.
Thanks, John. Rusty Rosemont.
Hey, good morning, guys. Great show. Jeannie, wish you were our governor, that's for sure. I supported you a couple years ago.
Thank you.
Anyway, I'm curious. Why did Ken Griffin put his money behind Richard Irvin?
That's a great question, Rusty. Thanks for the call. We've addressed this before. I mean, I like Ken, and I respect Ken and what he has tried to do to fund sensible policies and sensible politicians, including, you know, funding the opposition to the Pritzker attempted income tax, graduating the income tax, permanently increasing income taxes. But I think he has people around him that don't have good political instincts and are inclined to the combine way of life. I mean, certainly, I say he's got Ronner's political guys around him. He's got this gatekeeper named Kasen Carter, who was lashed to the mast of Ronner in 2018, despite warnings from me in particular, that was going to capsize very quickly, as it did. I think, you know, I mean, Ken Griffin is a kajillionaire. He's got a lot of interests outside of Illinois. He's, by the way, in process of divesting from Illinois, if you haven't noticed, with Citadel's operation in Florida. And I think he relies on his gatekeepers to give him political advice and direction. And he sees on paper Richard Irvin's resume, and he hears from these guys that he's the only candidate that can win, that we need to play identitarian politics like the left does. That's the only way you can win in Illinois. We need to mimic the other side. That's the only way you can win, despite the fact the one thing we haven't tried in my lifetime is conservative reform. That's worked in every other Midwest state around us when it's been tried. But we, as a Republican Party, refuse to try it, much less pitch it to a general election audience to see if maybe you want to chart a different course after the last 50 years of Illinois becoming the worst governed state in American history. And so he, you know, takes the advice and counsel of people around him. And I think he's removed from the day-to-day of the machinations of Republican Party politics in Illinois. And as I said, unfortunately, he's going to be embarrassed again. He's been embarrassed before in terms of where he's devoted his political spend, Rahner, Bill Daley, others. And he's going to be embarrassed again. It's unfortunate, but maybe this will be a learning experience for Ken, who may be a math genius and an empresario in the hedge fund space, but that doesn't mean you're a genius and an empresario in every space. And he certainly is not in politics. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Yeah, Pritzker is really afraid of losing to Darren Bailey. Can you imagine how embarrassing that would be for a bigwig like Pritzker to lose to a downstater like Darren Bailey? That's who he's really afraid of. And this election maybe like more like 1894, not 1994, Dan. That was where the Republicans absolutely pummeled the Democrats and gained over 100 seats in the House. Do we really want to miss that? Well, I think we do, according to the Republican establishment. They are intellectually sclerotic. They never make any adjustments. They just keep going with the same idiots. So,
Thanks for the call, Frank.
Keep going with the same talking points. So, state rep, state senate candidates have been told to stick to three things: crime, corruption, and cost of living. The three C's. Stay with the three C's.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and in for Amy J. This morning is former state legislator Jeannie Ives, now the principal at Breakthrough Ideas. And Jeannie, oh no, oh heavens, another celebrity crush of some conservatives is off the reservation. Barstool Sports president Dave Portnoy, and I don't really understand so many of these conservative celebrity crushes. I don't understand it. And this is another one. I don't get it. It always ends badly. But okay, here's David Portnoy on a recent podcast, Full Spend is the name of the podcast, talking about 2024, Biden and Trump.
Okay. Who you want for president next election?
Who's running?
Say with DeSantis, Trump.
There's two bad options to me. Trump and Biden are both real bad options. Trump more so because I think he'd be so divisive, like intentionally so. Like they are intentionally divisive, and that's their audience. But in this country, regardless of what you think of him as politics, I think he does get a bad rap for a lot of the stuff. But people, it doesn't matter. He's broken brains.
What do you get from going on Fox News then?
Huge audience. Like, what do I get from going on Nelk Boys? Huge audience. Like, honestly, it's areas we're not at.
Oh, I see. So Jeez. You go on Tucker Carlson's show just to advance Barstool Sports. It's not because you have any real interest in the great revolt that Trump sparked, to borrow a phrase from our friend Selena Zito.
Well, he's turned out to be a fraud, if that's how he really feels.
oh, conservatives and their celebrity crushes. Mm-hmm. Oh, conservatives, if you could just stick, not all of you, some of you, if you could just stick to assessing based on substantive work product behavior as opposed to shiny objects and silly YouTube videos about who crushed somebody in some 30-second exchange. The movement would be so much better off, don't you think? I could go through other examples that I've gone through on the show before, but
I won't
digress.
Well, there's this fascination with Joe Rogan, too. And I don't know that
Bernie
that's
Sanders
real.
Supporter.
Yeah.
You know, again, I mean, no, I know. And to you know. Criticize Joe Rogan, as I've done, is to, you know, engender
vitriol.
Negative reaction. Because if you're attacked by the left, that somehow makes you, even temporarily, that somehow makes you a conservative thought leader. No. Sorry, it doesn't. And David Portnoy is not much of a thought leader, period, much less a conservative one. But okay, I didn't know how to tell you. You can kill the messenger if you want. For more on this and a little preview of 22 and beyond, please be joined by the aforementioned Celine Izzito, national political reporter and author of The Great Revolt, Inside the Populist Coalition, Reshaping American Politics. Selena, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. You're my conservative celebrity crush, Selena, by the way. And it's because of content and work product. And speaking of which, since you're a Pittsburgh denizen, tell us about what's going on in Pennsylvania. You wrote about it recently and how perhaps the movement afoot in Pennsylvania could be as much of a bellwether for 22 and beyond as the Youngkin election in Virginia was.
Well, I mean, the biggest thing that happened in the past 3 days is, and it has upset a lot of conservative populists, is that President Trump endorsed Dr. Oz in the U.S. Senate primary contest in the state. Pat Toomey, the current sitting U.S. Senator, Republican, is retiring. His term ends next January. The election, the primary election, is next month here in Pennsylvania. It's between several conservative candidates, but most conservatives in this state do not believe Oz is conservative. And to your point, they think of him as a celebrity. So they were pretty stunned when Trump weighed in and endorsed him. And I have a story about that. People go to SelineZito.com. And I called around to, you know, county chairs across the state and grassroots supporters. And to a person, they were saying, quote, "What the heck was he thinking?" End quote.
Yeah,
only the word was heck.
Right. I mean, yeah, some of his endorsements are curious. Sometimes his decision making just generally is curious. But you know, and I don't know exactly what the relationship is. I don't know if you have an insight into why he made the decision he did in that contest. But in addition to that question, there's something else going on in Pennsylvania, too, and that is a continued move of so-called working class voters away from the Democrat Party. And, you know, this portends very well for not only that Senate race, depending on who the nominee is, I suppose, but also for Pennsylvania in 24.
Right. And so I think this is really important. You know, I wrote about this in 2016 when I was covering then candidate Trump's re-election, and he had and I had warned people that Pennsylvania had become 0.4% more conservative every 4 years, even though the Democrat would always win the state and their electoral. But nonetheless, I was right. Trump won. And the thing that's also been happening since then is the state has gone from 1.5 million more Democrats than Republicans, and that has whittled down to a half a million. And that is incredibly important. I mean, there are counties that have never had Republican majorities that now do. And the Republicans are outpacing the Democrats on a weekly basis by 4-1. That's incredibly important as the state moves more center-right. And counties are averaging 80 new Republicans a week. That's an astounding number in a state that most people associate with being solid blue.
Would you say that is primarily due to the national political environment, or is there something going on more locally or at the state level that is making an impact?
It's all of that.
Okay.
So one of the things that people ignored in 2020 in Pennsylvania, because Biden won the state, they didn't notice that down ballot, Republicans won big. They won two statewide row office elections. They held on to their two seats in Congress that they were predicted to lose by 8 points. They turned around and won them by 8 points. They were supposed to lose the state House and the state Senate. Not only did they not lose them, they gained seats. That move right was increased in 2021 in school board elections, county row offices, and I think what's most important, that happened in the suburbs where most reporters and analysts believe were gone to the Democrats. That flipped back, proving to me that, you know, everyone said Trump was just a one-off, and I've argued he wasn't the one-off. It's actually going to end up being Biden, because these voters are coming back.
So Joel Kotkin, who's an academic at Chapman University, he wrote a great book that's sort of consistent with your description of what happened in 2016, called Neo-Feudalism. He sort of uses feudal terms to talk about the class divide in this country between the clerisy, that's the managerial elite, or Michael Lindism, and the yeomanry. And he writes in Newsweek this week, in addition to the economic impact the staggering incompetence of the Biden administration is having on the working class, there's a political one. It's undeniably driving working class voters even further from Democrats and toward the GOP. But it's not all good news for conservatives. The recent Amazon vote to unionize could be a precursor to something less appealing to the right, a nascent rebellion among the vast armies of service workers who for decades have inhabited the lower economic rungs. The truth is, the rising tide of class conflict is problematic for both parties. Do you agree with Kotkin's analysis?
So I think there are sort of two different things at play here. I have, and I've said this on the show, this is not going to be a left-right election. This is an inside-outside election. And I think that the unionization of Amazon workers goes into that inside outside, and that there are, you know, working class, it's like saying all Catholics vote this way, or all evangelicals vote this way, or all Hispanics vote this way. Working class the geography plays so much into who the working class voter is. And if you live in a concentrated, heavily populated urban area, your worldview as a working class voter is going to be very different than someone who lives 15 minutes outside of the city. And so that's sort of the inside outside part.
But do you see? You see this move away from the left, and particularly in this inflationary environment where real wages aren't keeping up with the price of staples. But yet, not being Biden might be good enough between now and November, but it's not good enough for Republicans long term, for even the outside working class people.
I disagree.
You don't agree. Okay.
Yeah, I don't agree. The strength in this country politically right now is with center-right. I'm not saying Republican. Mm-hmm. I'm saying center-right. Sort of a pragmatic approach to governing, not just politicking, but governing. And Republicans have an opportunity to, as they did in 2016, to welcome new voters into their coalition. And they will in 2022. I believe they will also in 2024, as long as they are listening to these voters who have been left with nowhere else to go.
Well, I think that's what's happening in Virginia. There was just a recent article out about Governor Glenn Youngkin, and he did something I would love to do here in the state of Illinois. Probably can't do it because we have weird laws, but he made an amendment to a bill that moved up the elections for the Loudoun County School Board to November of this year.
Yeah.
Only that county school board, there's nine districts. They all are having to stand for election in just a matter of months. And so he's taking to heart what he saw happening in his campaign, and he's making things happen immediately for voters.
Yeah, you know, I covered that election in last year, feels like 1,000 years ago. I understood way back in August that it was over for the Democrats. One of the things that Youngkin keenly understood was consequences. And he understood consequences in multi different levels. It wasn't just school board. It was also crime, and it was the and those things were having a heavy impact on voters. So it doesn't surprise me that he did this, because of the way he looks at the world. And he looks at it as though, okay, there are consequences for your actions, and I'm going to make pay for them.
I love it.
What did you think of Governor Abbott busing a few dozen persons who entered this country illegally to D.C., try to highlight the lawlessness on the border problem that the D.C. press corps is trying to dutifully ignore best they can? Was that an effective way to do it, or should he just be doing policy at the local level and scrambling the National Guard to help enforce the border in his state and challenging the administration in that way?
He's doing what my grandmother and probably everybody else's grandmother always said, throw spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. That's what happens when you are in the middle of a crisis. The problem with this effort is it's voluntary, and it doesn't have the same visuals of people just streaming across the border. They're coming off a nice bus, you know, and the crack cafeterias are there waiting for them. And it doesn't have that distressing imagery that Texans, in particular Texan ranchers across the state, feel every day. In their own backyards, literally in their own backyards.
She is Selena Zito, national political reporter, author of The Great Revolt Inside the Populist Coalition, Reshaping American Politics. And you can always check out her writings at SelenaZito.com. Selena, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Sorry I didn't have a voice today.
That's all right.
Thanks so much for having me.
She joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Bust it.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in framing this morning is former state legislator Jeannie Ives, now at Breakthrough Ideas. And Jeannie, on the heels of the consumer price inflation in March, 8.5%, we find yesterday that producer price index up double figures. And so Jen Psaki had to do some splaining during the White House press briefing yesterday. And here's how she pitched it.
Well, the alternative would have been that we would have gone into a massive economic downward spiral, and many Americans would have not had enough food to put on the table. So we chose the other path.
We chose inflation over mass starvation is what she's essentially arguing.
Yes, and she's saying that's why they put out so much money into the economy, into people's
right.
hands. Yes.
Yeah, we were so that close it. To mass starvation, mm-hmm. but for the last $2 trillion in funny money the Biden administration printed. Uh-huh. Okay. Well, it's not just her. The Vice President of the United States, her name is Kamala Harris. Seriously, she's the Vice President. And she was in Philadelphia offering her customary keen insights into the situation.
Well, first of all, I acknowledge one must acknowledge that prices are going up and that people are working hard and in many cases are worried about whether they can get through the end of the month and make it all work.
Mm-hmm. Are Democrats embarrassed by her yet?
I acknowledge what one must acknowledge, which is that reality exists. This is consistent, though, with Kamala Harris's perspective on these matters, that things like acknowledging what one must acknowledge is true are things she does every day.
It is time for us to do what we have been doing, and that time is every day. Every day it is time for us to agree that there are things and tools that are available to us to slow this thing down.
It's undeniable that we must acknowledge what one must acknowledge every single day, Jeannie. Mm-hmm. For more on this headiness, we're pleased to be joined again by Christopher Whalen, investment banker and chairman of Whalen Global Advisors, LLC, author of Ford Men, From Inspiration to Enterprise, and editor for the Institutional Risk Analyst. Christopher Whalen, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Jeannie. What an honor.
Do you dare?
Otherwise you had been in the campaign management business.
do you dare to disagree with what one must acknowledge, according to Kamala?
Oh, I don't know what to say about Kamala Harris. She is just such a bizarre figure politically. You know, she bought that Senate seat she had by essentially guiding the national mortgage settlement in 2012. She took a couple $1 billion back to California, which she controlled, by the way, and then bought her way into big-time politics. The problem is that she is completely dysfunctional in a public setting. You know, it's not just embarrassing to your question. It's horrifying, I think, for Democrats to have a president who is, you know, getting on in years and probably at the end of his career, and then you don't have a vice president that you would even want to have take over for the president. It would be a train wreck.
And
the next one in line, of course, would be Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah,
so
here we are. She's unfortunately leaving us in January, I understand. So that's unfortunate for the left,
well,
I guess. Jen Psaki, you know, the funny money spend, the quantitative easing, I mean, this prevented mass starvation.
Well, I don't know. Look, the Democrats illustrate, I think, why presidents shouldn't talk about the economy very often. In the post-war era, we thought we could mandate economic outcomes by passing legislation in Washington, but that's not the way it works. And the external factors, the war in Ukraine, COVID, all the rest of it, that really influence life, the things you can't predict, are beyond even the scope of the Fed. The Fed was busily printing money, and then the bell rang, and all of a sudden they have to start pretending to care about inflation again. But in real point of fact, all they care about is nominal job creation. You know, they don't care if consumers lose ground every day because the cost of living is going up steadily, and it had been, even before COVID. We had an inflation problem in this country. Now we have a big inflation problem, Dan. And I think politically it's going to be devastating for the Democrats. You know, if Nancy Pelosi wasn't planning on retiring in January, she'd have to retire in January because her caucus would throw her out. That would be it. So, you know, Janet Yellen is the queen of inflation, our Treasury Secretary. She was the one at the Fed who said, oh, inflation's too low. We have to let it go longer. And I think that was the whole rationale besides this huge accumulation of Treasury bonds and mortgage bonds that are sitting at the Fed now, $8 trillion. Actually, I think it's $9 trillion. But it's a big pile. And the Fed can't sell it because there's no one to sell it to. So we have quite a mess. It's almost an Argentine kind of mess. We should start practicing our Spanish, maybe Italian. We could wave our hands. It's a very Italian situation we have in this country right now.
It just feels like another failure, though, by the smart class.
Yeah.
People that are supposed to know it all. And, I mean, it'd almost be better that they did nothing and just really just let the economy figure it out, let producers figure it out, consumers figure it out. Mm. They monkey with stuff, and then, you know, there's no, we're sorry. They don't even acknowledge that.
Mm. Well, you know, there's a great Chicagoan, Alex Pollock, who was at American Enterprise Institute for many years, and he ran the Home Loan Bank of Chicago for a couple decades, but really smart guy. And he said to me, Chris, the problem in life is conflicted agents. They're all supposed to be doing stuff for us, but they don't do it. And so we're surrounded by experts, the smart people, like you said, Jeannie, right? And they're supposed to tell us what to do, but they are clueless. The folks at the Fed are making it up as they go. I mean, and they don't like it when you criticize them. It's like the Church of Rome. If you raise your hand and say, but weren't you wrong about this? They'll never admit it because their stock and trade is confidence. If they admit that they don't know, they're afraid of hurting confidence. So this whole construct that we have, courtesy of Hubert Humphrey and Augustus Hawkins, that's the Humphrey-Hawkins law from the 1970s, was essentially a socialist deal that said, well, we won't guarantee everybody a job, but we'll make sure the Fed, you know, prints enough money so that we have nominal employment growth, even if people lose ground every day because their money is worth less and less, right? So this is America. This is the deal we have right now. And I think eventually it's going to get so bad that Congress, hopefully a Republican Congress, will be forced to redirect the Fed simply to price stability and leave the rest of it to the broader economy. Because we have enough curveballs coming at us every day that we don't anticipate, that if you don't have a stable price regime, then you're going to have inflation. That's really the bottom line. And this is where Germany went after the war. If the Bundesbank was running things and not the rest of Europe, they would have a price stability rule, and that would be it. They wouldn't worry about employment.
Jason Furman, who was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under Obama, came very close to making sense in a Wall Street Journal op-ed, writing that in addition to spurring inflation that outpaces wage growth, moving from a hot economy to an overheated one can also threaten the stability of job growth itself. Next time, let's remember that it's better to heat the economy by putting one log on the fire at a time instead of throwing them all on at once.
Of course. Look at housing. Yes. We increased the headcount in housing finance by almost 40% from April of 2020 until the end of last year. Now we're going to lay off a third of total headcount in housing because volumes are falling. We're going to cut in half the number of loans we make this year compared to last year, right? So you think of it, 2 years, it was a big help to the economy, housing. Now it's a drag. And there's not a whole lot the Fed can do because they're worried about inflation now, right? So we're going to be looking at 6%, maybe 7% mortgage rates in this country by the end of next year. This patient is not ready for that. That kind of medicine is going to put this thing into cardiac arrest. And everybody on the street, the chattering classes, go talking about how we're going to have 4 or 5 rate increases and Fed funds is going to be up to 3 or 4%. No. That's an alternative universe. I'm sorry. This market can't tolerate that kind of change over a short period of time. Because you know what it is, Dan? The single biggest factor that business and consumers are dealing with now is the volatility that we're dealing with, how quickly things change. That's what's tough for people.
So if we don't see that number of rate hikes over the next, say, 12 months, then what is the universe we will be living in?
You're going to have persistent high single, low double-digit inflation for a couple of years. You are going to have home prices continue to rise because there's no supply. And the other interesting thing, which I don't think has got nearly enough attention, is that the more affluent sectors of the U.S. economy, people who lived in cities, they went out and bought a house somewhere, but they kept the apartment in town. So we're taking all of that supply off the market that ought to go to another family by rights, but no, we need two homes now in case we have to pull the plug in the city and run out to the countryside again.
Mm-hmm.
Like Dr. Zhivago. You remember that scene in the
yes.
movie when they were hiding in Varricano before the communists came to shoot them? That's kind of where we are now.
Yeah, the Dr. Zhivago world. It was a lovely romance story. I mean, it didn't end terribly well. But yeah,
Who doesn't love Russians? I'm a quarter Ukrainian, by the way. So
oh, all right.
Close that.
Hey, listen, I wanted to get your take to just some bit of interesting news this morning. Of course, that's Elon Musk's hostile takeover bid of Twitter and how you'll react to the implication that would mean for big tech, the cultural import in addition to the economic one, if Musk was able to successfully take over Twitter.
Well, in the old days, the robber barons would always have their own printing press, their own propaganda organ. And even though Elon Musk is an enormously successful businessman, he has trouble managing his ego, clearly. He feels the need for adulation. So he's going to buy Twitter, and I suspect he's going to put his face up instead of the little bird. And then it's going to become like the analog to the Trump social media site. This will be the Elon Musk site, and then we'll have Trump, and all of these personalities will have to have their own. So I think it'll be good for the economy. Think of all the web developers who are going to be building websites.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it quite that way.
Classic. I always compare Musk to Bill Durant, the great speculator who assembled General Motors and had lost it twice to the banks. The second time around, he lost it to DuPont, which kept it as kind of a plaything for 30 years until Harry Truman made them sell it. But, you know, business and celebrity are intertwined, and even more today, I think, than ever before. So Elon is going to become a demigod. He's going to have his own little site, and like I say, his picture will be there instead of the little blue bird. But the question is, how many people are going to want to stay there if Musk is calling the shots? I have a funny feeling at the end of the day that he's going to get in so much trouble with the SEC that they may end up banning him as an officer and director of public company.
Oh, that's interesting.
He can't control himself. He's impulsive. You know, if he had a good lawyer, the lawyer would lock him in a room and give him the Dutch uncle session. Because, you know, the SEC doesn't like to lose litigation, but when you violate certain basic rules about disclosure and public companies, they'll shoot you in the head.
Yeah,
and
but
if Elon is banned, guess what? He can't be the head of SpaceX.
It's sort of a Hobson's choice where now you want to keep Musk and Trump off Twitter for their own good, but you can't live without them on Twitter or owning Twitter.
I wrote the Ford book. The one thing I have consistently said about Musk is he should have declared victory. He, you know, validated the whole idea of electric cars, even though I think lithium batteries are probably not a good way to go. And he should have sold it. Give it to Audi. Give it to Toyota. People understand manufacturing and the commodity nature of this business, right? Go make spaceships, Elon. You're a smart guy. Go help us go into space. That's where we need to go. And instead, he's getting drawn into this public mosh pit, which doesn't do anything for him, but it does feed his ego. So it just shows you how vulnerable we are as people. You got a guy here who's demonstrably brilliant, and instead he wants to go play around with Twitter? What a waste of time. You know, I love Twitter. Don't get me wrong. You know, me and my media buddies all hang out on Twitter during the day, but still, why does it matter?
Right. I would love to see a conversation between you and Musk. That would be That would be funny. Look, I
advise
him respond to that.
Public companies. I try and give them good advice. And if I had him in a room, I would say, what are you doing? You're pissing away your legacy just so you can be popular and go to, you know, Hollywood and the Oscars or whatever you want to do. No. Focus. Focus. It's like Kung Fu Panda. Imagine what Shifu would say to Elon Musk. Focus.
Yeah. I wasn't expecting a Kung Fu Panda reference from you this morning.
Most important movie ever made. I use it for training managers.
I love it.
I would make them watch it. I would say, what does this film teach you about dealing with employees?
He's as good as you, Dan. Dr. Zhivago.
Yes, he's got range.
We live in a movie. That's America. Yes. Life is a movie.
Christopher Whalen, investment banker, chairman of Whalen Global Advisors, author of Ford Men, from Inspiration to Enterprise, that is, and editor of the Institutional Risk Analyst as well. Christopher Whalen, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Have a great day, guys.
You too.
And you join us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and in for Amy J. This morning is former Illinois State Legislator Jeannie Ives, now the principal at Breakthrough Ideas, a West Point grad. And Jeannie, I wonder if you agree from your, you know, the education you got at West Point. One of the things, it seems to me, the Council on Foreign Relations, Foreign Policy Establishment inside the Beltway consistently has gotten wrong over the last 60 years, is this idea that every country wants to be part of this vision that globalists have for a new world order. And that premise leads you to misunderstand the interests of foreign adversaries like a Putin in Russia or a Xi in China.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think that we also think that everybody wants a democracy like we have. And that just doesn't seem to be true in certain societies. I think some of them are okay with more authoritarian structure and people telling them exactly how to behave.
We don't really have an appreciation for our country's history, so many of us, much less the history of other countries, and such that we understand the perspective of their political, we understand their political culture, and thus the perspective of the citizens to their government.
Yeah, but that's also because, look, our America's pretty young in the history of the world, quite frankly. So these folks, they date back thousands of years before America's founding, and they have a culture that is just different.
Built up over centuries.
Mm-hmm.
For more on that very topic, we're pleased to be joined by Marty Kari, who's a former Intel colonel in the Finnish Defense Forces, currently teaches cybersecurity at the University of Jyväskylä. I haven't brushed up on my Finnish in a while, so I hope I pronounced that correctly. Colonel Kari, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's nice to be with you. Good morning, Chicago, or good afternoon from Finland.
There you go. John Gabriel over at Ricochet directed our attention to a talk you gave in 2018 about this topic we were just discussing, sort of the perspective on Russia from an understanding of Russian history from, well, at least the era of the Mongols to present. And so, you know, what is your analysis of what Putin wants and maybe what the West misunderstands of what he wants and is willing to do to get it?
Yeah, I think our biggest mistake is that we think that they think in the same similar way as we do, but they don't. They have their own strategic culture, which is influenced by the history, for example, and geography. For example, in a long run of history, there has been a lot of attacks. You know, the Mongols has attacked the Napoleon, the Germans, we Finns, we have attacked them. We Finns have attacked them with the Swedes. The Poles have attacked them. So they have their family histories and their heritage. They have a fear of attacks. And the leadership now, the kleptocratic leadership, is using that fear in a very clever way, telling people that if they are not in lead, NATO will attack them. So I would say that, okay, 70% of the fear of the attack of NATO is caused by the leadership, and 30% is real afraid of NATO attack. So one thing in the history is that, okay, they are attacked, and maybe NATO will attack them again, once again. And other thing is that there is no borders, like mountains or seas or whatever protect them from the enemy. So it's easy to attack from the Poland. It's plain area from Poland to Moscow. So they don't have any obstacles as you have, for example, the big seas, Atlantic and Pacific seas between you and Europe and you and China. So the Russians have learned in history that somebody's attacking them, and it's easy to attack because there is no natural obstacles between them and enemy. And now the leadership is to stay in the power. They keep on telling that story that, okay, NATO is surrounding us and they will attack.
But does that concern about an incursion by NATO, is that just a cover story for Putin's czarist dreams of a Mother Russia from a bygone era?
I think the main idea is that they are afraid of the color revolutions, because the kleptocratic system goes in that way that if you get a position in administration, you get also possibilities to take governmental money, you know, the corruption. If you are in high level, you get a lot of money. If you are lower level, you get less money. But anyhow you are able to take governmental money, and you don't want to lose that position. And color revolutions means democracy, and democracy means that, okay, the leaders will be elected every fourth or every sixth year, so they don't want to lose their position where they can, you know, grab the money, and that's why they are against of those all what is going on in Belarus. There was a color revolution. They put it down. In Kazakhstan, there was, you know, they tried to get some kind of democratic movement. The Russians put that down. And now what they are afraid that what has happened in Ukraine will happen also in Moscow. So I think that's the main reason.
You, as I understand from your background, I mean, you spent time in Russia studying Russian history. So you're steeped...
Yeah, Russian language.
Okay. So, but anyway, you're steeped in the culture, and obviously your time as an intel officer in the Finnish Defense Forces. Mm-hmm. I wonder if the Finns' experience with Russia in the Winter War in 1939 has any lessons for today, because it's similar in the sense that Russia didn't, the Soviets at that time, didn't perform very well as an expeditionary force. They suffered heavy casualties. But at the end of it, they also were able to extract some land, in fact, more land than they initially wanted as part of the armistice with Finland. Does the Winter War of that era have any lessons for this one?
Yeah, I think, we lost 10% of our territory. And we had to reoccupied 400,000 inhabitants or refugees or displaced persons. And our population of Finland was in that time 4 million. So it means that we had to resettle every 10th Finn after the war. And I think that the Ukrainians, they have followed very carefully our winter war, because some tactics which they are doing now, which they try to do, for example, in west from Kiev, they try to make a surroundings. They try to surround the Russian forces and cut them pieces and surround them. They try to do that. They didn't succeed, but it was clearly seen that they try to follow the same tactics as we did in 1939-40 against the Russians.
So are they capable of actually taking over Ukraine, holding that ground long term? Are they capable of of no, really controlling it?
They are outnumbered for that, because now the Ukrainians they have 200,000 mobilized forces, and the Russians, they have in some areas they have less forces than Ukrainians, and Ukrainians pushing them back. For example, in south, mm-hmm. they are pushing them back already behind in the south banks of Dnieper again. So the Ukrainians are counter-attacking in some parts. Some parts they are holding the positions. So the Russians are not advancing, only tactical advancing close to Kramatorsk and also close to Zaporozhye. But mainly the Ukrainians are holding the positions or even counter-attacking.
And so how do you think this ends? And how long will it take to end however you think it ends?
I think the Russians, they don't have strength to conquer Ukraine, so there will be a moment when the Russians run out of the force, and there will be a ceasefire, and I think there will be one general attack in eastern Ukraine one more, and if the Russians doesn't succeed to get to the Dnieper, they don't get to Zaporozhye, Dnipro, and Kramatorsk, Slavyansk, those areas, the Russians are forced to accept some kind of ceasefire.
And will that ceasefire, do you anticipate, include the Russians grabbing more land from Ukraine?
I think the Russians, they want to have that Donbas area. It means that Donetsk and Oblast, Donetsk and Luhansk Oblast, it's like a county. Mm-hmm. I think it's county in your country. The Luhansk and Donetsk counties, they want to have them. And then they want to have so-called Novorossiya, which is that land area from the rebel areas to Crimea. I mean, the north bank or north coast of the Azov Sea. I think that's in that case, they can say that, okay, we won. We wanted to have Novorossiya. We wanted to guarantee the safety of the Donetsk area. They can say that, okay, we won because now we have them.
And despite his protestations at present, do you think that's something Zelensky and the Ukrainians will concede? I mean, for, you know, now flip the script, how long can the Ukrainians hold out and not concede at least some of the areas you just mentioned?
I don't know. I think that's a good question. I think it's real politics. If they had to give up from the Donbas, I mean those two counties or oblasts, they just had to. I don't know. I for the Ukraine, of course, but if that's only solution to get the peace, then Zelensky might have to accept that. Okay, those areas will go to the Russia. But of course, it's an interpolitical question also, because then the Ukrainian people might challenge their leadership. Why did you give up for those countries, even we were able to, you know, hold our lines and defend ourselves? It's quite difficult, that question.
Yes, and how do you leave your own countrymen behind under Russian control?
Yes, yeah.
Well, so, and here, the other thing, too, is if Putin is unable to accomplish what mm-hmm. you just suggested could come to pass, then does that weaken the regime such that he could have more revolts like you were talking in Belarus or Kazakhstan that the Russians would have to attempt to put down? I mean, I think we forget how big Russia is as a landmass, 11 time zones. You know, after this, and particularly if there's not a legitimate claim of victory with any sort of armistice, how weakened would Putin and his regime be?
No, that was a good question. I think I would watch now what will happen in Georgia, for example, Georgia, what will happen in Kazakhstan, what will happen in Belarus if Putin will not achieve his goals. If Russia saw that it's not so strong as we expected, so then in Belarus might happen something, in Kazakhstan might happen something, in Georgia might happen something. So I think this is not the end. This is the beginning.
He is Marty Kari, former Intel Colonel in the Finnish Defense Forces, who currently teaches cybersecurity at the University of Jyväskylä. And Colonel Kari, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your insights.
Oh, okay. It was nice to be with you.
And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and in for Amy this morning. Former state legislator Jeannie Ives, now at Breakthrough Ideas. And people want more information on Breakthrough Ideas, Jeannie, they go where?
Breakthrough-ideas.com. And we have a special event coming up May 13th with you and John Cass. And it's all about Illinois.
Well, that should be a depressing conversation. Mm. No, we'll have fun with it. We always
yes.
do. I want to talk about sort of a below the fold topic that really didn't come to my attention, really hadn't been thinking about until this profile piece in the New York Post about these social media influencers. And, of course, this against the backdrop of the big news this morning that Elon Musk is staging a hostile takeover bid of Twitter. The social media driven bimboification of America and American women, but I wouldn't really limit it to American women, young women. There's a lot of men walking around who are mimbos, to borrow from a Seinfeld.
Most of the politicians are.
There's no question about that. This is some instruction on how to be a bimbo. This is not being decried. It's being promoted by social media influencers who have hundreds of thousands, millions of followers and viewers. Mm-hmm. Here are the 10 rules for bimboification, if you're so interested. This from 19-year-old social media influencer Fiona Fairbairn.
My rules for bimboification. Rule number one is to stop fact-checking. If you want to believe a fact, just believe it, even with no research. I like to personally believe that Stevie Wonder isn't blind. Rule number two is to stop looking through phones and trying to catch people cheating or just lurking. Each time they bring out their phone, just don't even look. I don't want to know. The universe will tell me on its own. Rule number three, only focus on you and your looks all the time. Literally take 3 hours to get ready. And if you're only thinking about yourself, you will have no time to think about anything else. Rule number four is to show up hot everywhere. Doesn't matter where you're going, just show up extremely hot because you will get pretty privileged and people won't care that you are a little bit of an airhead. Rule number five is don't participate in discourse. When people ask you for your opinion on hot topics, just act like you've never heard of that before. What is a presidential election? Number six is just say IDK to every question, especially personal questions. What's your relationship status? What are you doing with your life? I don't know. Number seven is stop looking at the news. I don't want to know about the harsh realities of the world, and I'd rather pretend we live in a euphoric society. So I'm just going to stop looking at that too. Rule number eight is purposely do things you don't want to do wrong so you don't have to do them, especially simple tasks. So if you don't want to do the dishes and someone asks you, like, just don't even use soap. Mm-hmm. They'll never ask you to do it again. And you could just relax by the pool and get a bubble tea. Rule number nine is to stop observing and perceiving. Don't read people's body languages or overthink of what they're saying. Whenever you go into a room, don't think about if they're thinking about you. Just continue thinking about yourself the entire time. Rule number 10 is no critical thinking, no self-awareness, no thoughts, just vibes. Whenever you're thinking of the shackles of self-awareness, simply just think of a blank white wall and just have no thoughts and just vibe instead. I will be happy this 2022 and my thoughts will not put me in shackles no longer.
I tell you, I'm living about half of those rules, showing up hot everywhere, taking 3 hours to get ready, some of them. But I'm still shackled by thought. And this sounds very freeing. I mean, all cliches are true, Jeannie. Ignorance is bliss.
Well, you know, now that you've ran through the list, or she did, I would say half of them do apply to members of the Illinois General Assembly. 100%.
Not the hot part.
Not the hot
sure.
part. But
not the pretty privilege.
Like, facts don't matter. Make them up yourself. If you want to believe it, it's true.
I personally like to think of Stevie Wonder as not blind. I love that. that. I love that. I think she may be onto something. Certainly, those 10 rules could also be retitled How to Get Into an Ivy League School, How to Get an Anchor Job on CNN. There's sure. They are repurposable because the flip side, if you don't go through life bimbo-fied, as I'm, you know, taking under consideration, because the critical thought piece doesn't seem to be working very much. I don't know.
Do they have a golfer's version of this?
You know, actually, she's right about that. Actually,
yes.
The idea of not thinking while you're playing golf and just thinking of like blank space, no abstract thought, no thought whatsoever. There is something there, the relaxed mind.
Well, you're escaping
it's turned
Illinois.
Off.
You turn off the radio and you're down there.
Well, that's true. I'm
course.
In my own private
so,
utopia.
There's
yes.
a little bimbification there. Too.
No, there's no question. Like I said, I mean, I'm open-minded. I'm completely so open that there's nothing happening. Because if you aren't bimbo-fied.
This is another reason Dan Proft is single.
Yeah, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Only think about yourself. Just
right.
constantly.
Right.
You know, think about yourself, not in the terms of being self-aware. Now, this is where you have to thread the needle a bit. Because you're supposed to not think, and you're not supposed to think about others, and you're not supposed to be self-aware, but you have to focus only on yourself. And that's not an easy trick.
Right.
But the flip side is, you know, you could become one of these unbimbo-fied women who are doing things like that animal rights activist who attempted to glue herself to the basketball court at the Clippers-Timberwolves game this week.
Yeah.
And when I originally saw the story, I'm like, oh, she tried to glue herself to the basketball court. Anything to stop mediocre basketball in the NBA, I'm for. But that's not why. Apparently, the current majority owner of the Timberwolves has some chicken farms. And she wanted to bring attention to the killing of chickens at Glenn Taylor's factory farm by gluing herself to the hardwood during the Timberwolves-Clippers game. So, I mean, would you rather see young women go through life like that or go through life focused on, laying by the pool and emphasizing their pretty privilege?
How about my choice is either?
I don't know. Is there an in-between? You know, we live in such a black and white world. I don't know. The bimbo. The social media thing, though, I mean, we saw this with all the Varsity Blues scandal with mm-hmm. all these like Hollywood celebrity or Hollywood titan, the kids of these Hollywood titans, and they're flacking for cosmetics companies, making lots of money and so on and so forth. And then, you know, you created a fiction, believe what you want, create a fiction about your academic or athletic record in high school, and then your parents are getting in trouble with the law. That doesn't seem to be consistent with where we are as a culture at present.
No, but I mean, it does feel like we're, you know, Neil Postman amusing ourselves to death.
Yes, the bread and the circuses and the mm-hmm. pretty privilege. You have a daughter that's just started high school?
She graduates at the end of May. Yeah,
yeah, okay, so yeah. She's going to be yeah. starting high school. Mm-hmm. So what about, like, is this just sort of silly, you know, corner of the internet nonsense, or do you think these purveyors of bimboification are like a real cultural issue for young women? I mean, young men, too. I mean, what's the difference between young men and young women?
You know, I imagine that there are parts of our culture that are okay just kind of going along with this, but I don't really see it in where I'm from or in my daughter, her friend said, I think they find this entertaining, though. I think they watch this stuff. They
yeah.
certainly don't abide by it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
They can't. How can you make money doing abiding by that unless you're
a
million TikTok followers?
Yeah, well, that's
which
how.
Is somebody's people's, you know, ideal job. That's great. Fine. If you can make money off of people wanting to watch stuff, fine. Great. No problem, yeah. But most people can't. So most people can't be a bimbo.
Well, I mean, you have to commit to it, like Miss Fairbairn. You know, you can't half-ass it if you want to be a bimbo making money
on social
media. Hey,
good for them. Honestly, hey, that's great. Making money doing that stuff? Wow. I'm impressed.
Yeah. Yeah, all right. I don't know. I think she's pretty persuasive. I'm gonna take most of those rules under advisement, and I'll let you know what I decide, or you'll just know because this show will become very different. Dan and Jeannie Ives in for Amy J, Chicago's Morning Answer.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.